I am Plant on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. I am joined now by the novelist, historian, and essayist Ronald Wright. His new book is called What is America? A Short History of the New World Order. It is an awfully thought-provoking book that looks at the United States and our times, America's place in the world, and America's evolution from a frontier society to today's lone superpower. Ronald Wright has won many awards for his books, for his work. His previous books, A Short History of Progress, Stolen Continents, and Time Among the Maya, were big bestsellers. RonaldWright.com is his website. What is America is published by Knopf and retails for $29.95. It is a captivating and insightful book. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Ronald Wright. Good morning, Mr. Wright.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Nice to be here.
Who designed the cover of the book?
Well, it was the publisher, Knopf, but they were they acknowledged that they continued the tradition of the design that was used in my previous book, Short History of Progress, which...
I guess if you didn't read that book, you certainly saw it in bookstores. That's the one with the,
The one with the chimpanzee sitting on the bar stool.
Correct.
And so they went for a similar look, but here we have a rather offended-looking eagle. An eagle staring with an outraged expression on its face.
Who came up with a chimpanzee?
That was the designer, Bill Douglas, at the Bang in Toronto. And he was working for House of Anansi, who always, they're a Toronto publisher, who always publish the Massey Lectures each year.
This book on America sort of came out of that previous book, did it not?
Yeah, that's right. The I wanted to expand and go more deeply into some ideas that I raised in the last chapter of Short History of Progress, and that is really that the modern world is as we have it now because of what flowed from history's Big Bang, the collision of worlds set off by Columbus in 1492. And I felt that, you know, to understand the sudden, very, very quick rise to power of the United States and some of our other worldwide problems such as overpopulation, overconsumption, and the sort of reckless advance of globalized, unregulated capitalism, all of these things needed to be understood in their historical context, and that is a context that arose originally from the Spanish conquests in Mexico and Peru, and later from the very, very, well, comparatively rapid in historical terms, population of North America by white settlers, mainly of British origin, slaves that they brought from Africa.
You talk about 1492 as the Big Bang.
Yeah.
But prior to that, were there empires that, I mean, just you're talking to someone perhaps who, perhaps people listening to us may not know history very well, but empires previously were consisted of whom and what?
Oh, well, plenty of stuff before that. I mean, it's just that after that date, for the first time in thousands and thousands of years, the world becomes one place again. Human beings in very remote times, long before any civilization or empire existed, fanned out around the world and got into the Americas and even managed to sail over to Australia and many other places. But they became, after the end of the Ice Age, completely cut off from each other. And plus they ran out of food because everywhere, all over the world, the late Stone Age hunters killed off all the big game, almost without exception. I mean, there are places where some of it survived, but in general, there was a huge collapse of the game animals, partly because of climate change, but mainly because of human hunting pressure. So then people were faced, those who survived and didn't starve, were faced with the problem of what to eat next. So they'd always been gathering plants, but then that became the domestication of plants and the origin of agriculture, and that happened independently, probably in about half a dozen different places in the world, maybe even as many as a dozen. And we had sort of two laboratories, one in the Americas and one in the rest of the world, and both of these human laboratories, sort of social laboratories, if you like, took very similar paths, so that by the, when Columbus crossed the Atlantic, he found big cities and big empires and an array of food crops that were quite different from the ones in the old world. But nevertheless, the essential features of civilization were the same.
Well, when we look at previous empires, is there anything we can learn from them that possibly could predict what could happen to America, perhaps?
Well, yes. I mean, a typical pattern of empires is that they get hit by the law of diminishing returns. And this happened to ancient Rome, it happened to the British, it happened to the Spaniards, and it also happened to the Aztecs in Mexico. And that is that when you first become an imperial power and you pick the low-hanging fruit, you take over other hitherto independent peoples and appropriate their wealth and make them work for you, and at first you get more out of it than you have to put in. But as time goes by, the military costs and the infrastructure costs of keeping an empire going multiply, and the returns tend to decline. So I think the United States, even though it's an informal empire, is beginning to reach that point.
Why is it, though, that political leaders, such as the current president, President Bush, tend to think that their goals aren't for empire?
Well, America has always denied that it's an empire. I shouldn't say always, because George Washington called it a rising empire. And there were many Americans around at the time of about 100 years ago, the time that the United States conquered the Philippines and other remnants of the old Spanish Empire, when nobody was afraid to call it an empire. But a lot of Americans have always been uneasy with calling their nation an empire, because the essential myth in which they believe is that it is a beacon of liberty. It is the world's best hope. It is a kind of utopia on Earth. And empire doesn't fit with that. Democracy is what they want to talk about. And it is a democracy. If you were a white settler and you escaped from the old world of Europe and you went over to America and you had your little farm and you could vote and so on, it was indeed those things. But if you were a black slave, it certainly wasn't. And if you were an American Indian, then what you were seeing was an aggressive white settler empire constantly expanding and taking over one after another of the highly developed peoples who already existed in North America.
How does the myth of America, though, propagate itself? I mean, do they do that themselves, or is it, to a certain degree, those of us that are outside of America that perhaps let it become so?
I think, you know, obviously there are many professional historians in America who are well aware of what really happened in the past. So we're talking really popular culture, the kind of thing that is taught in high schools, and it is in this, and also historians who have written for a general audience in the past. I mean, one of them wrote that America was just a woodland when the Europeans turned up, and a squirrel could jump from bough to bough for 1,000 miles without seeing a bit of sunlight on the ground. You know, it's complete nonsense. The first Europeans found towns, fields, roads, even pyramids, and people were growing enormous fields of corn. They found that in Canada, too. Cartier's description of what later became Montreal is along those lines. So, but somehow the white settlers, in order to make North America not an imperial possession, something they took from someone else, but in order to make it into their own home, they had to deny that there were very many original inhabitants to begin with. And they also had to deny the sophistication of those societies, because at that time, and based on sort of biblical precedents, it was considered okay to displace nomads, because nomads don't really, you know, they just wander around, they're not really using the place. But it was wrong, even hundreds of years ago, it was considered wrong under international law to attack a civilized sedentary people who hadn't given you any reason for doing so. So the settled agrarian societies of particularly the eastern North America were converted into by propaganda. And I've actually nailed it down in the book. I mean, the propaganda starts within 10 years of the pilgrims arriving in 1620. They actually survived because they moved into a Native American town, lived in the houses, ate the corn, and then planted the fields of Indians who'd recently died from smallpox. 10 years later, they're describing the place as a wilderness and saying that there was nobody there to welcome them, no towns, nothing at all, and there were just a few savages who tried to fill their sides with arrows.
I was watching 60 Minutes the other night, and they had Bob Woodward on regarding his book, the latest book on President Bush, and he describes the president as being somewhat frustrated that the Iraqi people are perhaps not grateful that the American occupation is taking place there. Do you find that this delusion has happened throughout history? I mean, you mentioned
it happened throughout American history. Yes, when President Jackson back in the 1830s ethnically cleansed the eastern United States, and that's a sort of weasel word for mass deportation and extermination. He removed 100,000 people at gunpoint and pushed them across the Mississippi, and these were people who were farmers. They had adopted white technology. They were living in brick houses. They had mills, cotton farms, and people like the Cherokees had their own constitutions, supreme courts, and the Cherokees also had their own newspaper and had invented a script for their own language. These were highly civilized people, even in the European definition of that word at the time, and yet Jackson says that these are savages and they can't live among Christians, and therefore it is from the motive of philanthropy that the federal government kindly offers them a new home where they will never be disturbed by the incursion of white settlers. And so all these people are rounded up, put in camps. It's known as the Trail of Tears, this death march across North America to the other side of the Mississippi. And when they get there and manage to sort of rebuild from the ruins, they're only left alone for 50 years before the whole thing starts again. So that's one example. Another example would be the Philippine War, where Americans, in favor of conquering and taking over the Philippines rather than letting them become independent, when after the Spanish-American War about 100 years ago, said that it was okay for America to be an imperialist because her imperialism would be the imperialism of liberty, and that it was nothing less than the sacred duty of the Americans to educate, Christianize, and lift up the Filipinos.
So how do we get away from this delusion then, Ronald?
Well,
leadership?
I think it's going to be a long time before it sinks into the general popular culture of the United States that the record of America as seen from outside is less than rosy, and that many people fear what Americans may do, even if the average American is well-intentioned. That said, though, I should say that America has been a force for good in the world in the past, and is perhaps still coasting on that to some extent. There's no question that Woodrow Wilson after the First World War and Franklin Roosevelt at the time of the Second World War, although they came into those two wars late, made a tremendous effort to create a new international order, a multilateral order, not an imperial one. Woodrow Wilson founded the League of Nations, the forerunner of the United Nations. Roosevelt didn't live to see it, but soon after the war, the Marshall Plan went in. There was a great deal of reconstruction. And at that time, it was the idea was to create in the Western world societies where which we were called welfare states unabashedly at the time. The idea was you wanted full employment, and you did not want to let people sink into poverty or be without access to health care or any of those things, because the lesson of the 20th century was if you don't look after the weaker members of society, what you get is mass unemployment, Bolshevism, Nazism, revolution, terrorism, and war. And America learned that lesson and did its best to teach it to the Europeans and to produce the post-war world that ultimately has come down to us as the European Union and the United Nations. But since about the Ronald Reagan era, which is much more recent, has given up on those ideals and wants to just do things its way, does not want, has pulled out of things like the Kyoto Accord, the International Criminal Court, the ABM Treaty with the Soviet Union, and so forth. And so there's been a kind of regression to an old-fashioned, almost 19th century America.
Do you think it'll get worse before it gets better?
A lot will depend what happens in the next election.
This November?
This November election. I think not only has America kind of lost its way by falling into the hands of extremists, and I feel it's perfectly, it is not going too far to call the Bush regime an extreme. It is the most extreme right-wing government in any major Western country since 1945. And it has been deliberately contemptuous of international order and even things like the Geneva Conventions and its own constitution, imprisoning people without charge and so forth. So I think if there's a change of government and the Democrats get in and clean house, that might help restore America's reputation in the world. And it's also really maybe the last chance that American citizens have of reclaiming their democracy from people who are religious fanatics, war profiteers, big oil, and political extremists.
You know, it's funny that we all know that, it seems. Americans seem to know that as well. When you look at the polls today between McCain and Obama, they seem to be running neck and neck. It would seem to me that it would be a slam dunk for Obama to win in November and for the Democrats to win, and to use that trite phrase from the primaries, to have closed the deal already. What is it about Americans and how they vote that they're not able to do that, that it still remains a very divided country?
It is a divided country. I mean, I think in a way, in this election, you're seeing the old fault line of the Civil War back there, although it's taken a new form. It's not between North and South, but it's very much between the intelligentsia and the better educated urban populations, particularly on the coastal states, on the one hand, the people who look back to what I call Enlightenment America in the book, the America conceived as an ideal of democracy by people like Jefferson. That's one half, and in the present day, they tend to be lining up behind the Democrats. And then the other half, which goes right back to the beginning, are these Puritan fanatics who believed that God had given them the New World as their promised land and that they were his chosen people. And, you know, Sarah Palin, Republican vice presidential nominee, just said in the last couple of days that she felt that the Iraq War, the biggest mistake of the Bush administration without question, the Iraq War, was part of a divine plan. And that is not only crazy, but it's frightening for the rest of us, because the whole way in which democracy is supposed to operate is that voters make a rational decision based on the facts. And if you think that God is taking a hand in world events, you're not making a rational decision on the facts. It's also extremely dangerous for international order, because other countries can't really deal with extreme regimes that are driven by fanatical beliefs.
How does Canada factor in all of this? We're in the midst of our own election as well.
Well, Canada, if our polls are to be believed, and I suspect probably that things will change between now and mid-October, but a lot of Canadians have bought into this market fundamentalism that was spread around the world by beginning really with Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, this tearing up of the lessons of the 20th century, this idea that we don't have to regulate capitalism, we don't have to legislate against pollution, we don't have to protect labor, we don't have to protect the environment, because we just let business rip and it'll make everyone rich in the end. And that is essentially the neoconservative economics, and it's also what we call globalization. We know that those ideas don't work, because it's really a return to late Victorian and Edwardian practices, and it ended in the wreckage of the First World War and the Russian Revolution and the Great Depression. Unfortunately, a lot of people in the short run, you can create an economic boom, but you're gobbling up assets in the long run. You're degrading the environment. You're overexploiting resources. You're paving over the farmland. Unfortunately, a lot of people in Canada still believe that these policies are good ones and that they are going to make everyone rich. It's sort of like buying a ticket in the lottery. I hope, though, that we get a little more sophisticated and see that these ideas are already discredited. And if we sort of continue along that path by re-electing Stephen Harper, we're sort of in the situation of being rather provincial, a kind of province of the American Empire, carrying out an idea that's already shown to be bankrupt in the Empire's heartland.
In terms of the reaction to this book, did you write this book? I mean, is a book being published outside of Canada?
Oh, yes, yes. No, it's being published in several countries, and immediately I finish the author tour here, I'm off to Australia.
And do you find that you find the audience enjoys or buys into your argument, do you think, that they agree with you?
Well, it's too soon to answer that. In general...
I guess, Ronald, I asked a question in terms of why you wrote the book. I mean, there must have been...
I wrote the book, really, I suppose mainly because I was baffled by how the rest of the world went along with so many of the more extreme and dangerous policies of the most recent Bush regime. And I felt that perhaps a lot of that was based on a misunderstanding, that perhaps many of us still do believe in America as a sort of benevolent world policeman, and had failed to take note not only of how extreme and how dangerous a regime such as the one that's just on its way out can be, but also how deeply rooted that kind of thing is in American history. I mean, George W. Bush was just the latest in a line of presidents, including Reagan, including Nixon, going all the way back to Andrew Jackson, who are essentially do not conceive of the public good or international order in the way that most other countries do, or even, say, the more enlightened half of America. So we shouldn't really be doing business with these people, or at least we should be stepping back from the most dangerous adventures that they try to draw us into. So I guess what I'm trying to do here is point out the patterns. I'm not trying to beat up the United States. There are wonderful things about America, and almost all the criticisms in my book are actually quotations or based on sources that are written by Americans. It's just a matter that we need to get away from these popular myths about what America is and what its role in the world is, and have a more realistic approach and a more multilateral approach, and reach out to other countries, diversify our foreign policy and our economic policy, not rely so much on our big neighbor to the south. I'm speaking as a Canadian.
And we should care wherever we are, whether we're in Canada or outside of Canada, not in the United States, of course, what happens to America, right?
Well, you know, if America were not so powerful, both economically and militarily, we could take the attitude that it's none of our business what they do. And that would be fair enough. But because America's actions affect everybody, its failure to cooperate on cleaning up pollution or even signing treaties like the Law of the Sea. I mean, there's another international treaty that was drawn up in the 1970s and torpedoed by Ronald Reagan. Other countries have signed on. The United States still hasn't. When the pollution that is created, the overconsumption of resources, these affect everybody. And then when you get military adventures as well, then very much we do have to, it is our business. It's our business to mitigate and contain the threats and hope that we can work with more enlightened, more internationalist American administrations in the future. But we have to be aware that this pattern of a very regressive, archaic, unilateral, and I would say in religious terms, fanatical side of America comes to the surface quite regularly, and we need to be aware of it and think how we're going to deal with it.
What are you working on now? Are you working on another book?
No, not yet. No, I'm going to be traveling for pretty much the whole of the fall on promotional tours for this one, so I haven't got time to sit down and start worrying about what to write next, but it won't be another short history. I don't think I have much more to say at the moment. I think I'll probably be writing a novel next.
Well, continued good luck with this book. It is, as I said, a thought-provoking book and fascinating, and congratulations on it, and as I said, continued good luck with it.
Thank you very much.
The book is called What is America? A Short History of the New World Order, $29.95 from Knopf. RonaldWright.com is the website. For the commentary, I'm Joseph Planta.